Hi, everybody. It's David Rhodes with another episode of Fire Engineering's In the Books. And I'm joined today by author David Clark, who has just written Residential Firefighting Training and Drills that it was just released a few weeks ago. And David Clark, for those of you who don't know, served as a firefighter and fire chief and fought fires with rural, suburban, and metropolitan fire departments. He became a field instructor and later full-time instructor for the State Fire Academy of what's now the Illinois Fire Service Institute. The IFSI's deputy director, he oversaw more than 600 instructors, staff, curriculum, training, academic, and research activities for the Institute, which has about 60,000 students per year from Illinois, the U.S., and around the world. He served as an instructor at the Fire Department Instructors Conference and numerous conferences and fire schools, provided technical assistance and review of several fire service books and videos. He is the author of more than 20 articles in fire service journals. He participated in curriculum development and helped write training manuals for the IFSI, the Illinois Office State Fire Marshal, the International Fire Service Training Association, and the National Fire Academy. He holds degrees in history, fire science, and adult technical and vocational education. He served as a sergeant in the Army's 3rd Infantry Regiment, the Old Guard. He's on the Illinois Terrorism Task Force and on the Central Illinois Critical Incident Stress Debriefing Team. He retired after 45 years in the fire service. David, welcome to Fire Engineering's In the Books.
Thank you. Glad to be here. My pleasure.
So, what years were you at IFSI?
I taught my first class at IFSI in December of 1975. I was a field instructor for about a year and a half and was hired full-time. And I retired there as deputy director in 2010. So it's about 35 years or thereabouts.
Well, I'm going to throw a couple of my old acquaintances out that I hung out with over my career. I just retired. It's coming up on 3 years ago, and I did 37 years. So see if any of these names ring a bell to you. Jack Rutledge.
Oh, yeah. He and I were on the fire department together in Normal, and then he got hired by the university to, that was before they had any EMT or paramedic programs, and he'd been a Navy corpsman with Marines in Vietnam. And so the university hired him to develop basically an EMT type program for the fire service. And then before he got that done, politics got involved and the Illinois Department of Public Health decided they ought to be doing it instead of the fire service. And so they took that over and JR just stayed with teaching fire. And then a year or two later, he got me hired as a field instructor. And then after that, as a full-time instructor, and he and I tag-teamed and taught together for years.
So he is actually, he lives down here close to me now. He's
He's Peachtree City.
Yeah, and he retired from Delta as their one of their safety gurus. So I actually did about an hour interview with him about probably a year and a half ago. He came and saw us at one of the classes I was doing. Well, if you know that cat, then about the same time would have been old Cortez Lawrence.
Yeah, Cortez talked with us for a couple of years. Actually, someplace in the file, I've still got a, he was kind of an amateur artist, and I got a picture he had drawn of my three kids when they were just little toddlers and had decked out in fire gear with pike poles and axes and titled it Truck Company Clark. So
that's awesome. Yeah, he drew all his own Christmas cards. He got to be pretty good. Pretty good at his art, and his daughter actually, I think she works for Disney as an artist. So, the genes ran in the family. So, what'd you do in the Army? What'd you do in the Third Army?
Well, it's basically a leg infantry unit, but also doubles as a ceremonial unit. And I was a casket team leader, basically the main thing I did. But we did all kinds of ceremonies and stuff around D.C.
Gotcha. And the old guard there—that's the group that guards the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, right?
Right. Yeah, I was not part of that. At the time I was there, you had to be between 6 feet and 6 feet two to be a tomb guard, and I was 5'10", so I ended up with a casket team, which probably better duty than walking that tomb anyway.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, when Cortez passed away, he actually had full honors, and they had the big band and the caisson drawn
Yeah,
horse drawn.
I used to do that all the time.
Garage, yep, that was
That
very
was quite
nice.
an honor to do that.
So other than your time at IFSI, what departments or departments did you work or volunteer for? I started
out as a kid, literally chasing fires in Brimfield, which is a small town in central Illinois, and I started hanging out in the firehouse in the evenings and so forth. And the guy that was fire chief there used to give me, and this is back in 1950, used to give me his old fire engineering magazines and San Francisco firefighter magazines and volunteer firefighter magazines, and I'd read them cover to cover. And then when I was about 13, I started riding the rigs. I'd been pulling hose from fires before that, but I started riding when I was 13. Nobody was quite particular back then as what they are today. And then I was chief there from 1976 or so till mid-80s, 10 years or so.
Right.
And partially at the same time that I was on the fire department in Normal, where I'd gone to college. And when I was there, my shift captain, George Cermak, had been an instructor for the Fire Service Institute. He'd been a field instructor for the Fire Service Institute for a number of years. I used to help him do house burns, and he also rode with the Chicago Fire Department. He had been, as a kid, started out there as a photography buff in high school, taking pictures of fires, and then got hooked on the fire service himself. So he ended up as a fire captain in Normal when I knew him, and then he was chief there later on. But he started taking me to Chicago to ride with him. And for 7.5 years, every third weekend, I spent in Chicago riding.
Awesome.
Riding there, mostly at Engine 77, which is a busy engine at that time. Tail end of the war years, it was slowed down some from what it had been, but they were still doing 20 to 24 runs every day and, you know, several lead outs. And that was fires before they started sending ambulance engines on ambulance calls. So basically, it was a great place to learn firefighting. Mm-hmm. And it really helped me by the time I became an instructor, because I could relate to people from a rural department, a small city fire department, or a metropolitan, and relate to their problems and how they had to deal with things and so forth. And it was just you couldn't ask for a better chance to learn, to pass it on, you know, as an instructor. So it was a real opportunity to do that. So those are the fire departments I was really associated with. I was never actually on the Chicago Fire Department, but I spent a lot of time there. And actually, when I retired, the commissioner gave me a honorary chief's helmet for Chicago for all the work that FSI had done with training the Chicago Fire Department over the years. So we had an office in their academy and trained all their people. So we didn't do all our training, but we did a lot for them. So anyway, that's kind of where I came from. But most of my time has been as an instructor or, you know, supervising instructors and research and curriculum and actually doing the teaching. FSI is basically a hands-on fire training operation. We did things for certification. We did things for college degrees. But the gist of the whole thing, the emphasis is on hands-on. How do you go out the door and do the job?
Right. Did they have the research institute then, or was that something that was added later?
That's actually the research stuff. Jack Rutledge is the one that really got us started on that. And we started looking at things, heat and, you know, heat flows and streams and a variety of different things. And then it just kind of grew into the main real research we got into, or the first one was with turnout gear and so forth, because the thermal encapsulation was coming along and people were having a lot of problems with that.
Right.
And so
still do.
We did a lot of research on that for years. And then I guess they're still doing some of that kind of stuff and spinoffs from that. But we worked on a variety of things, building construction. The wooden I-beams is an example. Mm-hmm. We stopped over at the Small Homes Council, which was part of these University of Illinois research stuff there. And we stopped over one time to borrow some thermocouples from them, because we didn't have any at that time years ago. And we got to talking about these wooden I-beams and the problems we were having with them. And they got a real sheepish look on their face and said, well, we're the ones that invented those. And if we knew what you're telling us about it, they'd have certainly been different than what they are, because we did not consider at all the fire aspect of them. He said, we had a contract with the U.S. Forest Service to stretch the number of trees in this country as far as we could stretch them. And basically that's what they did, but they did not consider fire at all. So we got them interested in fire, and later on they started doing some research on fire stuff too. And but that just started, really kicked the door open for us on doing research of various types. So we did all kinds of things after that, and it's really grown into, you know, labs and full-time
full staff,
researchers, yeah. PhD researchers and so forth, rather than a bunch of firemen playing around to see what happens if you do this.
Right. So Dave, residential firefighting training drills. Why'd you write this book?
Well, actually I didn't set out to write the book. It started out to be, my original idea was to make a DVD of how you fight house fires. And the last few years I'd been at FSI, we had produced a series of CDs and DVDs, basic training things, and Illinois Firefighters Association had paid for them, and we distributed them free to every fire department in the state. And I wanted to follow those with this one on residential firefighting, because I think people mimic what they have seen, but some of them haven't seen fires fought right. So if they can see it, then they know what to copy, basically. Right. So that was my intent. But after I retired, when I was working, I didn't have time to write the script for it. After I retired, I tinkered with the script a little bit, but then I got a new director at the Institute, and he wasn't interested in producing any more of those down and dirty DVDs. And so it was kind of in limbo. And Mac McCaslin, well, actually, Rich Valenta, the guy that produced those DVDs for us, he had showed a draft of the script to a guy who had been a retired assistant chief for ops for either Madison or Milwaukee, Wisconsin, one or the other. Mm-hmm. The guy took a look at it, the script, and he said, well, this is the kind of stuff we ought to be teaching all of our people. You ought to give it to write a book and give it to fire engineering so everybody in the whole country, rather than just Illinois people, can have access to it.
Right.
And I gave that some thought, but I was still wanting to do the video. And Mac McCaslin, our associate director, every time he'd see me after I retired, he'd say, DC, when you gonna write your book? And I'd kind of blow him off, and DC, when you gonna write your book? And actually, that's it. Writing a book's the only one thing I've ever had on my bucket list to do. And so it got me thinking about that. And so after a couple of years, I started changing this script for a DVD into a book format, rewriting it as a book. And after a couple of years, I sent it to Mark Hall, who was in the position to look at that stuff at that time. And Fire Engineering did accept it. And so then over the next couple of 3 years, I kept tinkering with it and changing that and expanding it. And I kept a notepad and pen by my bed every night. In the middle of the night, every night, I'd write some idea down, and probably drove the editors nuts with all the changes I kept making, and drove my wife nuts with all the scribbling in the night. But anyway, we finally got it done, and that's how it came about. It started out to be a DVD to show people how to put out fires and how much fire they could handle. And it evolved into a book, basically, to pass on information that we'd accumulated and learned over the years and pass it on to other folks. So that's kind of how it evolved.
So it was a couple of decades in the making, I'm assuming.
Well, at least a decade.
At least a decade. All right. I see John Norman wrote the foreword for you. How did you guys meet?
John and I met at IFSTA. I had, over the years, worked on Essentials Manual, Ground Ladders Manual, and John and I worked together on a Ventilation Manual, and that's how we met. He had gone to OSU with Jim Straszewski, who was instructor with me at IFSI. They'd known each other when they were in school together. Mm-hmm. And so John and I met there, and then we invited him and several other FDNY guys to come out and teach for us. John was a firefighter at Rescue 3 when I first met him.
Okay.
And we've just been friends ever since. And, you know, he's been down here to visit, and we've been to New York to visit his family. He and his wife are down here. So we keep in touch all the time.
Awesome. Over your 45 years working in the fire service, what were the biggest changes that you saw in tactics?
I think probably the biggest thing is getting people away from using booster lines. because when I first started, that's what most everybody in the rural fire service used, the idea of conserving water. And even a lot of city fire departments used booster lines for fires that they probably shouldn't have.
Right.
But that was one of the biggest changes, getting away from that, putting an adequate amount of water on the fire. And then with the, you know, the breathing apparatus, when that came along, some of the changes in turnout gear and so forth, then you had the capability to actually really go inside a building and go after a fire rather than just have to try to do what you could from the doorway or the windows or take a duck in and duck out and, you know, that kind of nonsense.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I came along in 85 and that was right at the beginning of the mandatory breathing apparatus wearing. It was, wasn't 100% mandatory, but it was highly suggested. And then within a year or two, it was mandatory. And I was lucky enough, I guess around 94 or so is when I had my exposure to the first thermal imaging cameras. And that was the big Carnes Iris that was, you know, you had to have a special helmet to wear it. And it had a basically a computer monitor in front of your face and a counterweight over on the side and a battery pack attached to the thing. And
first was, one I ever saw was when I was a normal, and it was a small thing, really? As I remember. But we didn't use it much because we figured I'd break the windows out and you can see. Right. And
yep. So this thing was a monster. And then the other one for me was actually not that long ago, probably within the last 15 years, was really working through with UL and doing the research and being on the panels up there, is really learning the effects of ventilation and how you really had to have your fire attack and ventilation coordinated, because under the modern fire load, everything's too rich to burn. And when you open it up, it just explodes into fire. So that was the two biggest ones for me.
Well, that's the other thing that we really tried to push for years at the Institute was adequate water flows, you know, coordinated with the proper ventilation, you know, adequate ventilation at the right time and in the right spot.
Yeah. And this seems like, with the advent of the really good bunker gear and you know, equipment improvements, some of the old things that were done were lost because of the ease of being able to get in. And then now we're kind of going back to learn that those fire dynamics and all, they kind of dropped off for a little while. And now it's a resurgence. And even like the transitional attack and all that stuff, it's been around forever. It's just sort of, it was lost for, you know, a couple generations.
Yeah, I mentioned that in the book. Yeah. You see the old common sense firefighting or the modern catch of, you know, transitional attack. It's the same basic thing. You got to change the conditions so you can, if possible, get inside and do your job.
I always laugh at the guys, say, I've never done a transitional attack. I said, you ever walked up to the front door with fire blowing out, started flowing water to kind of beat your way in? They're like, yeah. I said, well, that's what it is.
So, yeah.
I like the fact that you mentioned in the book that despite all the changes and the basic concepts and everything, we're still pretty much on those same, locate, vent, confine, and extinguish. I mean, it's still the same. We just got better equipment than we had back in, you know, the 70s or what have you.
Yeah, this is FSI's 100th anniversary year. Mm-hmm. And I look back through some of the old things that were being taught almost 100 years ago, and they were teaching, you know, not only firefighting, but they were teaching EMS stuff and they were teaching technical rescue stuff. They didn't necessarily call them that, but that stuff was being taught. And I know the Brimfield Fire Department, a little department I started out at, they sent their chief down there to a fire college in like the 1920s or early 30s. And he got home, asked him, what'd you learn at that fancy school? And he said, I learned one thing. You got to ventilate, get in, and get water on the base of the fire. 100 years later, we're still teaching the same thing because it works.
Yeah, it does. It does. I also I was surprised when I saw it, but I was like, yes, you bring up some of the gimmicks that come along, and everybody's always got a better snake oil to be able to put fire out with, and nothing so far compares to just plain old water.
No water. That's it. Yeah.
Oh man, that was a good one. One of the my favorite parts of the book, because I'm kind of a search guru, and keeping up with that is, I love what you have in the search and rescue section, and I'm going to read a quote from the book. It says, when a career lieutenant who had made more rescues than the entire department combined was asked how he was able to do that, he replied, I go in and look for them.
That's it.
That's awesome. That is absolutely awesome. I know during my career, especially in the 80s and most of the 90s, it seems like, and I was with a couple of fire departments, a small suburban fire department, and then I moved up to Atlanta. But both departments is like, the primary search wasn't done until after the fire was put out. That was kind of the, that was just kind of the way it was. And that started changing for me in the companies I was in, probably in the mid 90s. But did you ever see where like the primary search was the number one focus, and then it went to extinguishing the fire, or was it extinguishing the fire as the number one in your time?
I think realistically for most departments, it was go after the fire, and the search is a secondary consideration. I would say that in larger departments, I know FDNY is an example, it's very regimented.
Right.
There are people searching right off the get-go. And, you know, some other big departments do that too. Chicago would do searches. But for the average fire department, it was not really realistically and actually, if the truth was known, first thing being done, or the first watch that people were having.
And a lot of that's just because staffing levels is, they didn't have enough people to do multiple things simultaneously. So they tackled the first one first, then moved on to the second and so forth. That's kind of the way we were in the small department, is you better get a line on the fire and get it knocked down, or you were going to lose the,
or everything's getting worse. Yeah.
So have you heard of the rescue survey that's out there now? Have you kept it up with any of that?
No, there's I a really group, haven't. There's now, a, I did see on one of your podcasts, I think Jeff Rothmeyer or something, mentioned something about some statistics they'd gathered. And I don't know if that's part of what you're talking about or not.
Yep. So that's kind of a bottom-up initiative. It came from a group of guys, and they're collecting data off of, they look for news stories through Google searches, and they follow up. And so they started tracking how many rescues there were, and getting up around 3,000, I think, since they've been tracking it. But, you know, there's almost one a day somewhere, if not more. And the stats, they'll follow up with the fire department, and they'll get some basic information about the fire and the rescue if they can. And what the stats are saying, that's if from the time the first unit gets on the scene, if you can get that victim out in the first 4 minutes, they have a 70% chance of survival. And that's a game changer for us, knowing that in the tactics and the things that we do. It may be that now rescue is moved higher, or not rescue, but search is moved higher up, and we have to do things a little bit different to try to beat that timeline. I've saw over the course of my career where there were so many safety policies put in place that, you know, my God, you had to have 12, 15 people on the scene before you could even go in the building. And, you know, this had to be in place and this had to be in there. And, meanwhile, the police officer, walks in and makes the rescue while you're circling the building, establishing command and doing all that stuff. And, I think it's kind of been a punch in the face to see these statistics and say, hey, you know, we don't want to be unsafe, but we need to really rethink some of what we're doing, because we could be wasting a lot of time up front.
Absolutely. And I'm trying to make that point in the book. They've got just a matter of a few minutes for you to get them out of there. It doesn't matter after that. But part of the problem is not just, as you're saying, a lot of departments are slow to even think about search, but when they do search, they're slow in searching.
Right.
They're not aggressive, and they're not playing the odds of where people are most apt to be, and, you know, get in there quick and see if you can find them. Because we watch people train, you know, training and doing searches, and we just, they're slow. It's aggravatingly slow. It takes 20 minutes to search a two rooms or something sometimes, right, with the way these people normally operate, until you try to show them some, a more aggressive way to do things. And you can't spend 20 minutes searching the house and find any viable victims.
Right. And, you know, your backgrounds in adult and technical and vocational education, I think we instill that in a lot of recruit schools, because the first thing we teach them is that left hand, right hand search from the front door. And if we don't go any further than that and teach them to play the odds, as you said, then they just go back to that on, you know, every incident they go to. It's like, oh, okay, you're assigned to search. So they just hit the front door and go right, and they knock out that living room when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and the victims
problem
are
upstairs
in the bed. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny that you use that term, play the odds, because that's one of the things I have in my classes on search, and I actually compare it to the Vegas book on blackjack. And it's like, if you know, you're playing blackjack and you don't know what to do, you look at the dealer, you go, what does the book say? And the guy goes, book says hit. So you hit. That doesn't mean you're going to win, but it means you have the highest probability of winning. And it's the same with search. At 2 o'clock in the morning, you're going to kind of naturally assume that somebody's in the bed or bedroom. So you would start there. It doesn't mean they're there, because maybe they were up cooking or whatever, but with the amount of time you have to be successful, you got to play the odds. And I think you mentioned VES, and it just surprises me. There's so many departments still that are afraid of the term VES. And I think that's one of the most effective methods.
I was going to say, that's one of the basic things.
Yeah, it's just the most effective way to get somewhere quick, right? What's your thoughts on VES?
I believe in it. I think it ought to be the accepted way to go about most situations, because you don't have time to wander around through a building full of smoke and heat trying to get to the place where you should be.
Right.
You know, go right to it, you know, get water on the fire, but get somebody searching right away rather than 15, 20 minutes from now after you got the fire knocked down.
Right. That's what somebody used to ask me all the time. They'd be like, well, how long? We would be doing survival school. They'd say, well, how long can you last in there if you're out of air? And I said, how long can you hold your breath? It's about the same amount of time. Exactly.
Yeah.
The resources and drills in the back of the book. So why did you feel it was important to add those resources that you did? And I noticed you're right up to date with the organizations and things that you mentioned in there.
Well, I think that people need to, as you said a little bit ago, find out what's really going on research-wise. Some of the things we thought in the past weren't right, perhaps, and other things have been confirmed to be absolutely right. So you need to stay up with that so you're aware of what the facts are, not just what the supposition or what the old legends are. And then people need to train on what's been found out that we need to be able to do. We need to be able to get lines laid, get water on the fire, get ladders up, get people in, get the place ventilated, do whatever needs to be done. You need to be practiced at doing that. And the fact that you did it 6 months ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago when you went through a recruit class doesn't mean you can do it today. And so skills deteriorate very quickly. And most of us, fortunately and unfortunately, don't go to enough fires to be good at what we're doing. And so the only way you can stay good and current is by practicing. And a lot of departments don't train enough. I mean, company officers ought to be training their people in something every day.
Right.
It doesn't need to be a long, drawn-out thing, but they need to spend a little bit of time every day on basic skills and basic thinking and procedures and so forth, what we're going to do when we get to a fire. And so any departments, unlike, you know, in the war days when everybody was busy, you went to work, and you knew, okay, we're going to go to fires today. Well, mm-hmm. I know a lot of departments today that they go to work and they just hope they can go to a fire because they haven't been to one for several days or several weeks, you know. So the mindset is different and the ability to perform is different. It's like a basketball player that didn't shoot free throws for 6 weeks. When he stands in the line, he's not going to make it. So Right. You've got to practice. Yep. And this was just a way to, with the drills there, I thought about writing out drills in detail, but my way of doing things is probably a little different than your department would do it. And it doesn't matter to me as long as either one of them can get the job done, get a line in service or a ladder up or a door open or whatever. That's the thing they need to be able to do. How they do it, that's up to their department. So I just really made lists. So these are the types of things you need to be able to do. How you do it, I'm not going to tell you how to do it. You do it the way that works for you with your equipment and the people and training and so forth. So that's kind of the thinking behind that. But when I was a chief in a small town, we burned at least 3 or 4 times a year, we would burn a house.
Right.
And so guys were getting into fires every 3 or 4 months. They were spend a whole day working in fires and so forth. So it wasn't unusual for them to be find themselves in a burning room or in a burning building. So,
right.
And that makes a difference.
It does. And the acquired structure training was just so valuable for departments to be able to get in everything from just opening up walls and seeing how the windows work. And
yeah,
and
even if you can't burn them, you can take a building and tear it apart. Right. And that's very important to learn how to do that.
Yep. And it's a shame that we don't burn as many acquired structures as we used to. For those departments that are still able to do it, it's certainly a blessing for sure. Because
there's the nothing best thing like you can do to train people.
Absolutely.
I know at the time when the NFPA standards started coming out about all that stuff, and there was a lot of hoopla about house burns and so forth. Well, the International Society of Fire Service Instructors ran on officially record at a meeting at FDIC to be opposed to some of those standards because they said, we're not opposed to safety and proper training, but these standards are going to cut out the ability to do house burns.
Yep.
Right. We're going to lose something.
Yep. And we did for sure.
Yeah.
It shows up in the amount of, and the lack of knowledge of fire behavior and fire dynamics, which is, as a structural fire control instructor, that's where I learned that stuff was like, you had to get, you know, 32 burns out of a house. So you better know fire dynamics and behavior and know how to close things off and pre-ventilate and,
Absolutely.
And that all translates over to actually being.
I remember looking at watching a video of a news video of a fire in the Chicago suburbs. They had a house on fire and a couple houses on each side of it on fire and a garage in the back on fire. And they got there and two guys on a line started in the front door of this little place and they were kicking the daylights out of it. And the chief came up and pulled them back. There's guys all over the place. There's two of them on the scene doing the right thing. And the boss pulls him out because he's afraid it was his first fire. I found out later his first fire as a chief, and he was gun shy of getting somebody hurt,
right,
and pulled him back. But that's just an illustration of, I think, one of the problems that we have. Sometimes people are so safety conscious and so afraid and don't go to enough fires to know what they can do
right
safely and how much they can accomplish if they do it right, that we're our own worst enemies sometimes.
Absolutely. And it's just amazing if you do take the time and learn what two or three people can do with one fully charged 1¾-inch line at the right spot. I mean, you can put out a tremendous amount of fire with just a couple of people. And that doesn't mean we should not staff our departments and all, but it's like the capabilities of a knowledgeable person can sometimes outweigh, you know, a crew of five that doesn't know what they're doing.
That's one of the things that struck me the most when I first started riding up in the city of Chicago. We'd go to fire there and you'd see in 45 minutes or an hour, two engines and a truck had put this thing out. And if this was a downstate fire someplace else, It'd be mutual aid for four or five departments, last all night long, and in the morning you can look from the basement right out through the roof.
Right.
And all you got's a skeleton standing. Just exactly what you're saying. You know, people that are trained well, know what they're doing, can do a tremendous amount of good in many cases.
For sure. Well, I look at this book as a resource for anybody that wants a down and dirty review of tactics, as well as a great resource for some daily training. I mean, it's not really a field guide. I mean, you don't have time for a field guide when you're doing residential firefighting, but it is something that you don't necessarily have to just sit down and read it as a book front to back. It's like you can go and pick out, you can go to the table of contents and like pick out garage fires or attic fires or whatever, and use that as a daily training exercise, and then ride around your territory and find something and discuss, you know, the concepts in the book, and then match it up with a little drill in the back that gives you objectives. And I totally love what you did with that, by letting people determine their own methods and tactics, if you will, but giving them objectives, like, you know, you need to be able to ladder the second floor window, you need to be able to stretch a line to the second floor, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And if they're doing the right things, that's going to put the odds on your side in most cases to put the fire out. And I think that most fire departments, even small rural fire departments, have got enough water going with them today. And if they've got, like you say, an inch and three quarter, 2.5 inch hose, a master stream of some type, they can put enough water on most residential fires to put them out.
Right.
Now, obviously, you get a major apartment building sometime, right, it's going to be hard to handle. But most of them, I think, have today, in today's world, have got the capability to put out most of the residential fires they go to.
Yeah. And the studies have shown that, you know, it's less than 500 gallons is typically what it takes to actually control, you know, a room or two of fire. And and everybody's carrying at least 500. You know, a lot of them are carrying 750. So there's a lot of truth to that.
If you can go with, you know, 500, with 250, a 2.5 inch line will knock down a lot of fire, inside or outside. And a couple guys can do it. Mm-hmm. You know, they got master streams now, the 500 gallon a minute flow, which is not a lot, but it's enough to knock down most fires. And then you get serious master streams, you know, 1,000 gallon or more. You can handle a lot of fire. And that's one of the things we always tried to do on house burns was, you know, once you've milked it for all the 1 and 2 room fires you can get out of it, then get the whole doggone place going and kick the daylights out of it. Just show them, hey, you can handle this. Mm-hmm. I had one department we'd done a lot of training in, burned houses several times, did a lot of classes. And they called me up one time. They'd had a fire in a grain elevator complex in the center of town. The fire in the middle of the night, the fire had been spotted by a cop in a town 10 miles away, saw the glow in the sky and called these guys. And they got over there and they put the fire out. Now, the chief called me the next day. He said, it's on a weekend. He said, the state arson investigators are not working on weekends now because of financial problems. This is years ago. He said, can you come over and take a look at this for me and tell me what you think happened? So I went over there and I saw this grain elevator that had a lot of fire in it. And they'd put it out. And I said, how in the world did you do that? And he said, well, we had pre-planned it. One of our instructors had been there and they'd pre-planned that thing and who was going where and what size lines and so forth. And he said, and we'd burned a house for him a while back before that, within a year or so before that. And while we were inside doing some fire behavior stuff, one of the guys came in and he said, one of the trustees is here and he's getting anxious to go home. So he set the machine shed on fire to try to burn it down while you guys are in the house so he could get out of here quicker. So I said, well, screw him. We'll go put it out. So we went outside real quick and got 3 or 4 lines and just kicked the daylights out of this machine shed. Went back inside, started burning the house again. Well, the chief told me, he said, when we saw this grain elevator and thought back to that machine shed that you guys put out that was totally involved in flame and you stopped it right now, he said, we knew not to let flame buffalo us. Mm-hmm. He said, that's how we put that out.
Yep.
And that's really what I wanted to do with the video initially, was to show people how much fire they can handle so they don't let flame buffalo.
Yeah, especially at night. It's even worse worse at night than it is during the daytime. You have two fire blowing out of two windows, and the initial company officer will be like, "We got a fully involved house." And you're like, "No, you got a room and contents blowing out two windows." How long have you been retired now?
Oh, about 13 years.
13 years. So, obviously you keep up with things. You were talking about you're watching the podcast and stuff. So what's your advice to the new guy coming in the fire service?
Find somebody on your department that is a good fireman, a good aggressive fireman that knows what he's doing, not just got the t-shirt, but knows what he's doing, and latch on to him and show him that you're worth investing in. And once he realizes that you're worth him investing his time and energy in, he'll teach you all kinds of stuff, but you got to show him you're worth his investing in. But you get with somebody like that and they'll teach you a wealth of things that you can't get anywhere else probably. So basically hang around with a good fireman and copy what they do.
But you got to take the initiative. And that's something that I saw, is that some of the younger guys expect that somebody's just going to get up and do it for them. But the older guys, they want to see that you're actually interested in learning.
Right. Absolutely.
And they will, then they'll,
but if they are, then they'll, if they sense you're genuine, they will invest in you.
Yep.
And it's, and getting back to Mac McCaslin, when he was trying to encourage me to write this book, I said, "Well, these kids, they don't want to hear anything from some old dinosaur like us." And he said, "The good ones do. They're hungry for it."
Yep. I agree 100%. And looking through the book, I mean, it's timeless stuff, but it's up to date, in the recommendations. And, I think it's very, very well done. Any final thoughts on the book itself? What do you hope that the reader gets from it?
I hope that they get enthused about reading the basics and remembering the basics, the fundamental things the points I try to make in that book, teaching points. So when they go out the door, they will be thinking of, I got to get adequate water. I got to, do the basic things that need to be done. And that, it's fairly simple. It's like I said in the book, it's not rocket science. You do the basic stuff, and more times than not, you're going to come out okay on a situation. Right. If you don't do the basic things, the fundamental things that have been shown to work over the last umpteen years, you're going to have problems.
For sure. What's your next project?
I just encourage them to learn constantly, train constantly. It's easy to not train,
right?
But make yourself train, make your companies train. And like a friend of mine, who was a company officer in Chicago and then later chief of training up there, but his guys used to complain about when he'd make them go out and raise the aerial. We do that at fire several times a day. Well, if you're as good at it as you say you are, it's not going to take us long to do it. We can go out there and do this, and then we're going back and watch TV or something.
Yeah, you can get it all done. There's still plenty of time to watch TV. You can get it all done in a day. It's probably a lot simpler, though, when there wasn't a TV. Now you got TVs and cell phones and computers, so it's a little bit tougher. You got to spend a little more time. Well, awesome. It is it's a phenomenal book. David, it's been great talking to you and talking about some of our mutual acquaintance. When I see old Jack Rutledge again, I'll have to tell him that we did this, and maybe send him a link to it. I think he'll be surprised, and he'll enjoy it also.
Yeah, I'm sure he will. Yeah, I talk to him every few days or email back and forth if we don't talk on the phone. So, yeah.
You got to set aside some time. You got to set aside some real time if you're going to talk to him, though. It's not going to be a short conversation.
But our Colonel Janie, he was director of the Institute. I worked for him as his deputy. He was talking about Jack. He says he generates ideas faster than a kindergartner in a sandbox. And
he's a good one. He is such a great guy. All right, everybody. It's residential firefighting training and drills. You can pick it up at fireengineeringbooks.com. It's going to be a great resource for you. You're going to enjoy reading David's thoughts, and really it's a daily resource for you as a company officer, for sure, to help you out with your training. So I'm David Rhodes for Fire Engineering. Thanks again to David Clark, and this is another In the Books.